Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Bye.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Chicago's violent crime rate has been on the rise for several years, but 2016 has gotten off to an especially bloody start. During the week we recently spent in the city, 10 people were killed in shooting incidents and 88 were wounded.
We have a challenge right now, specifically but not limited to the South Side and the West Side, where we have a level of shooting and a level of gun violence that's unacceptable and must come to an end.
The numbers are staggering. More than 200 people have been killed and more than 1,300 wounded in at least 1,500 shootings across the city. A marked increase from the same period in 2015.
Chicago is no stranger to gun violence and gang activity, but with increases of up to 60 to 70% in homicides and shootings, well, alarm bells have been raised all over the city.
I view it as a disease. Like diseases spread, that's how this violence is spread, because I'm seeing it everywhere.
Gwen Baxter lost her son to gun violence 4 years after losing her husband in an officer-involved shooting.
Tell me about the loss of your child.
I got a call, like about 1 o'clock in the morning, telling me that Larry had been shot. He got shot in the back of his head and he died on the scene.
What did you do to emerge from that?
Like I said, I prayed and then I got angry. Well, I felt like I got to get up and do something. I got to do something. I have a
history. Today, Gwen organizes a meetup for other mothers who've lost family members to gun violence.
these killings and this violence is affecting everybody. When a person get gunned down, you have a mother, you have a father, you have sisters and brothers, and then this anger, this grief, this pain, that dark place that they're going to is affecting the whole family unit.
Who do you lay the blame or the responsibility?
Everybody is at fault. People in the community, the politicians, the police department, the people that are supposed to serve and protect. Everybody has a role in this disease that they cooked up.
Attention has largely turned to the Chicago Police Department. In November, a Cook County judge ordered the city to release this video showing Laquan McDonald, a black teenager, being shot 16 times by Jason Van Dyke, a white Chicago police officer. The video sparked national outrage and unrest, and Jason Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder. The police department was subsequently accused of fostering an entrenched culture of racism and abuse. Between a turbulent police department and a dramatic spike in gun violence, the city has arrived at a critical moment.
Move over here now, away from me. Move, move.
To gain a better understanding of what's going on inside the ranks of the police department, we interviewed a veteran officer on the condition of anonymity. He spent much of his 20-year career undercover working the gangs and guns beat.
From an officer's point of view, what were the consequences or effects of the Laquan McDonald incident?
Respect for the police is, you know, very limited in certain areas of the city of Chicago. It's become more and more difficult to police. I know a lot of really talented officers on the Chicago Police Department that aren't doing anything. You know, they're afraid of getting jammed up, meaning sued or fired for doing their job.
But if an officer does their job, you know, they shouldn't run into trouble, right? I mean, Jason Van Dyke was acting outside of the law, right?
Well, you know, I'm not really going to comment on pending litigation with that particular case. But I can tell you that since that incident occurred, it's become a state more of depolicing than policing now. And it's tragic. It used to be a job where it was just a lot of fun to go out there and, you know, take guns off the street, get dope off the street. And I feel as if our hands are tied right now. And there's a lot of bullshit paperwork involved now that makes officers want to kind of really not be aggressive and go out there and you know, fight crime. I think it makes them want to just pick up a paycheck and just say, fuck this.
The officer's claims echo a widespread attitude of discontent within the police department. Willie Cochran is a former Chicago police officer and current alderman of the 20th Ward.
Do you think right now, as a former Chicago police officer, is Chicago PD depolicing?
It's a fact. And there are different causes for it. You have to police appropriately. You do your job. We pay you to do your job. Serve and protect this community. Do it or you don't need to be here. On the other hand, if I'm trying to do my job and I got all of these obstacles, barriers in the place, and I actually want to do my job, it becomes frustrating.
In the wake of the Laquan McDonald controversy, Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced that the city would immediately implement changes to the department, including a system for increased accountability and changes in officer training. Emanuel also fired his police superintendent and appointed Eddie Johnson to the position. Johnson is a lifelong Chicago police officer and trusted by both the rank and file and communities of color. We were unable to reach Johnson during our time in Chicago, but he agreed to a subsequent phone interview.
At the beginning of the year, we had three major things happen. One was the Laquan McDonald video came out. Second thing was we lost our superintendent. And state law changed in terms of how we documented these investigatory stops. But you have to remember, the numbers that we had before, we should never see those numbers again, because now we're concentrating on stopping the right people for the right reasons at the right time. Business about depolicing, I don't think that that's an accurate reflection on what's going on in Chicago.
CPD's own numbers seem to contradict Johnson's response. During the first 4 months of 2016, there were just under 35,000 investigatory stops, down from over 230,000 during the same period in 2015. So we asked the department to clarify with a written response to the allegations, which actually acknowledged a reduction in officer activity in the first few months of the year, saying that it was, quote, mainly attributable to regulatory changes in the way we conduct investigative stops and apprehension over officers' actions becoming the next viral video. The department also detailed a number of internal changes to address the problem and claimed that policing activity has returned to average levels since mid-February, citing an increase in gun-related arrests, a figure they referred to in explaining the drastic change in investigatory stops. It remains unclear if this has done anything sustainable to quell the violence, which shows little signs of slowing down. For Gwen Baxter and others who have been personally impacted, the need to address these problems is as urgent as ever.
When you joined the force, you swore to serve and protect. And if you're not serving and protecting, you need to move around. You ain't doing your damn job.
And it doesn't seem to be any compromise with her. It's her way or the highway. And that's not going to work for the citizens of the city.
A Southside alderwoman today rejecting Mayor Lori Lightfoot's claim that 99% of her critics are motivated by racism or sexism.
The mayor said she's being judged in ways her two previous white male predecessors were not. Our political editor Mike Flannery is here now with more on this. Mike.
Well, Sally, the mayor told Channel 11's Chicago Tonight broadcast that virtually all of the criticism she faces comes because she's a black woman.
About 99% of it.
Expand on that.
Well, I mean, look at my predecessors. Did people say that Rich Daley held a tea session with people that he didn't disagree on? Rahm Emanuel was a polite guy who was a uniter? No. Women and people of color are always held to a different standard.
Agreements like this one last week that was captured by reporters at City Hall with the mayor called the mayor's claim a, quote, cop-out.
The same way that I challenged her, I've challenged Rahm, and I'm challenged Daley. So who does that go for? And I was a community organizer then. That's not true. That's the cop-out. That is the cop-out. At the end of the day, it is her responsibility and her duty as our co-worker to pull us together and have us figure out plans that work for our community.
And indeed, the plans that many aldermen, a couple of dozen or so, are concerned about are those for this 4th of July weekend. Jeanette Taylor is one of nearly 20 members of the City Council seeking to convene a meeting this Friday to bring Superintendent David Brown in to discuss police deployments and plans ahead of what some fear could be a dreadfully deadly weekend. The mayor says police have previously provided briefings to all aldermen. I'm political editor Mike Flannery. Back to you guys.
For more on this, let's bring in Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Always great to see you, and here you are. Here's Mayor Lori Lightfoot. This is what she said on July 1st. Take a listen.
This has got to be an all-hands-on-deck approach. It's not just on the police department, not just on the fire department, not just on elected officials. All of us have to embrace our notion of community and step up and think about what we can do.
One of those aldermen that said that that was the wrong thing to do was Chicago Alderman Raymond Lopez, basically saying that she allowed staff to go on tradition, on vacation before what is traditionally the most dangerous week in the city of Chicago is outrageous. Is that fair criticism, sir?
Well, it's the kind of criticism that she's gotten a lot of, unfortunately for her. And that is that she's trying to juggle too many balls in the air at once and hasn't really been able to get a handle on an issue like being able to enforce her own order, saying her own all-hands-on-deck order, being able to enforce that while at the same time letting a couple of her top staffers, her chief of staff, and her chief operating officer go on vacation. It sends a mixed signal that tells people, well, she really is governing by news conference and not actually governing hands-on.
What do you think about, let's zoom out, just Chicago, we do talk about that every weekend because it's significant and the loss of life and the violence is way up there, again, over the weekend. But today, the White House, President Biden is going to be meeting with some mayors to talk about the crime wave. He's inviting Eric Adams, who just won the Democratic primary here in New York. And it's sort of like a canary in the coal mine for Democrats, because here comes the 2022 elections. And I think that the Democrats seem to start to realize that if crime is going to be listed as the top three and the top one for 60% of the people in the country, that they have a lot of work to do. Can they do anything to turn this around, or will Republicans be able to take advantage of this when those elections come around?
Well, you're right. This is an important issue. And at the same time, crime fighting is not new to the Democratic Party. This is the kind of debate that goes on routinely in the party. And you're right. There was a long period where Democrats wanted to move away from the incarceration explosion. As a result, cash bail has fallen out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of complaints in Chicago from the police, especially, that people are being bailed out who shouldn't be bailed out. Well, that's an enforcement issue. Same thing with electronic monitoring. We've put several scandals around that. People are starting to tighten up on it. But I think Eric Adams' victory in New York didn't surprise me at all, because remember how popular Rudy Giuliani was as mayor. Bring in Bill Bratton to crack down with his broken windows approach. There's still a pendulum going back and forth as to which approach is best. But as I say, I think the fact that Eric Adams is succeeding shows that at the grassroots, people mm-hmm. care about crime. They want more police in their neighborhoods, and they want to do something to stop this incarceration explosion at the same time.
Clarence Page, always good to get your thoughts, and thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
The meeting yesterday between the Chicago mayor and the
sure.
president, can you talk at all about the request that she made of the administration in order to crack down on crime in that city? There was a report that she requested federal support. Did that involve troop presence in any way?
I don't have any a summary of the conversation in that regard. I don't know if that's something they've read out from their end. From our end, what the president conveyed to Mayor Lightfoot is that he will continue to work with her in partnership and work with cities around the country to address the rise of violence, and specifically the rise of gun violence, which is predominantly the driver in Chicago. He also reiterated that as the Department of Justice had announced just a few weeks ago, Chicago is one of the cities that will be beneficiary of these groups that will go and help them help directly crack down on combating drug violence and gun violence and gun trafficking, something that we are doing in about a half a dozen cities across the country. And he also reiterated his continued efforts at the federal level to crack down on the illegal passing of guns. So there has been a great deal of funding that has been provided already to the city of Chicago, Cook County specifically, certainly some of that can be used to address crime as well.
How is the DOJ's strike force going to specifically interrupt the networks that are trafficking these guns?
They're going to work directly with the city. We're doing these strike forces in about five cities around the country, and they want to work directly with them to use legal authorities to crack down on illegal gun trafficking and work in partnership with law enforcement authorities in the cities and add that additional heft and resources.
And lastly, is there any push to, fund more efforts to equip police departments? The White House position was that Republicans defunded police. Obviously, the Biden administration has talked a lot about the budget proposal for the COPS program, but there's been some pressure that the administration hasn't vocally enough talked about this spike in crime.
I would say the president gave an entire speech on it, and will continue to speak about what he's doing. A big driver of the rise in crime is gun violence, a personal passion of his for decades. I will say that there are a number of components. I know you referenced the budget, but the president called for a $300 million increase in funding for the COPS program. That's up from $237 million in the last budget passed by President Trump to $537 million. And he also calls for an increase of $753 million over 2021 levels to federal law enforcement agencies. It includes ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. It also includes $10.2 billion, an increase of $465 million over 2021 enacted for the FBI. Go ahead, Steve.
also don't believe in drugs. For years, I paid my people extra so they wouldn't do that kind of business. Somebody comes to them and says, I have powders. If you put up $3,000-$4,000 investment, we can make $50,000 distributing. So they can't resist. I want to control it as a business, to keep it respectable. I don't want it near schools. I don't want it sold to children. That's an infamia. In my city, we would keep the traffic in the dark, people to call it. They're animals anyway, so let them lose their souls.
Just worked. One violent crime is one too many. Over the four-day weekend for Memorial Day, there were four murders, which was the lowest in 10 years. At this point in the year, there has been 4,759 guns recovered by Chicago police officers. I want to highlight one gun recovery. There was a gun trace of a March gun recovery in 2021. March, this gun was used, as well as in this incident, October 26, 2020, October 27, 2020, and again, October 29, 2020. So my call is for more serious consequences from judges for illegal gun possession. I'll now turn it over to Glenn Brooks, the Director of Community Policing, and I'll come back after Vaughn Bryant and take your questions. Thank you. Glenn?
Good morning. So I first would really like to thank Director Norm Kerr with the Mayor's Office for help leading this whole government approach. This weekend we concentrated within four zones throughout the city, and in those zones it was really a partnership of city departments that helped contribute to the safety of the overall neighborhood. Specifically, I want to thank BACP, Department of Buildings, who really focus on illegal gatherings and legal parties throughout the weekend, which we have known has been a source of violence. In addition to that, the Park District, CPS, and other agencies came together to provide rolling recs throughout the weekend for young people to be positively engaged during this period. Streets and Sand was a great contributor in really making sure in those areas that we paid extra attention and really focusing on the cleanup, and we'll continue that throughout this week. Lastly, the community partnerships. I would like to highlight Hands Across Chicago and Support the Surge, which is a group of faith-based leaders who are really out there all weekend on different corners, positively occupying that space, providing prayer, providing a sense of positivity to some communities that have struggled with violence in the past. Their contribution, along with the hard work of the officers, have really made a significant difference this weekend. And it's really important to note this. This is just the beginning. This is one of 16 weeks. And as we go throughout the summer, we'll continue doing this every single weekend. And we're looking forward to the rest of the summer being as safe as this weekend. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Vaughn Bryant with Metropolitan Family Services. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. I'm Vaughn Bryant, Metropolitan Family Services, and standing with me is Yolanda Field of Breakthrough Urban Ministries. One, I want to thank you guys for having me here today. Wanted to just acknowledge Communities Partner for Peace, one of the largest street outreach networks in Chicago, working in 28 communities, but our vast network includes Ready Chicago, Chicago Cred, and Activists Inc. And between the four of us, we cover 33 different communities with 14 different community-based organizations across the city. We do a combination of street outreach where we hire people from those communities who have relationships and with a license to operate in those communities. But we couple that with case management services to make sure that not only are we stopping shootings and killings and conflicts, but helping people move their lives forward with whatever services they need. That could be behavioral health services, it could be legal aid services, it could be job training, We help people get their GED, and we subsidize it. So, you know, again, it's not enough to stop the shootings and killings. We have to give alternatives for people to move forward. As part of that, we look at the data and we start to shift our hours in the summertime to make sure we can cover 7 days a week. We can cover the early a.m. hours. We also employ a strategy that we call FLIP, where we look at the blocks that are the hottest across the city. This year in 12 communities and 72 blocks across the city, we hire additional FLIP workers, folks who are have influence on those blocks to make sure they sort of keep the peace on their particular block, on their corner. And when we look at the history of us doing this, we've been able to quell violence on those particular blocks. So that's something that we employ. Additionally, we have a light in the night strategy, which is a place-based strategy where we have events. We flood the communities with events. And this year, because of COVID restrictions, we're doing it more on a block-by-block basis, sort of having block parties where we bring out food. Again, things like Rolling Rec, we have activities to just make sure we flood the community with positive activities to drive out the negative activities. And so those are the type of strategies. Additionally, non-aggression agreements where we try to mediate conflicts and leave room for us to intervene, again, and help people move their lives forward. You know, we're here for the long haul. This is something that's not going to change overnight. But if we can continue to have this support and continue to build momentum, you know, our goal is to influence every Chicagoan in a positive direction. And we just appreciate the work that we're able to do in conjunction with Chicago Police Department. They have their particular lane. We have our particular lane, and we all have the same goal. Thank you.
Now I'll take questions. Yes. See, he was ahead of you. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, I think you heard it from Von Bryant. I think this collaboration can't be underestimated without street outreach and violence interrupters. Their influence in the community has been hampered by coronavirus. So last summer, because of the quarantine, they were unable to influence in the ways that they would have without the pandemic. And they have stepped up, even though we're not completely out of the restrictions, they really have stepped into the gap, particularly regarding some of our neighborhoods that are increasingly more violent than others. They're there till 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning with our Chicago police officers intervening in ways that Chicago police officers can't to reduce the violence. That is the highlight of the difference, along with the whole of government approach. I think the mayor rolled this out on Friday. I think some people think that's, we've heard that before. No, we haven't. That's a new approach. That's an approach that puts all hands on deck. It includes many departments being out in the field during the hours where violence is peaking based on historical data. And it's had a significant impact early on. One violent crime, one crime is one too many. But this approach really is a great launch for the rest of the summer. We have a lot of work to do. No one celebrated anything. Four people lost their lives over the weekend. And we are in prayer for those families, but we're also determined to continue to have an effect on violence through this collaborative approach, this whole of government approach. Yes. Number one, I think we're increasingly more data-driven. And we look back over 3 years of data. It points us in certain neighborhoods, those 15 zones, those 15 neighborhoods, those two zones, I think is important for it hyper-focused. That's not to say the rest of Chicago doesn't receive a similar dynamic, but we're hyper-focused on the most dense parts of the city that have the highest violence. And then once we have success there, obviously we try to scale that success, increase capacity, while at the same time, you know, we're balancing officer wellness with this because, you know, last summer we went nearly 20 days with extended hours and canceled days off. That is not sustainable. And I focus grouped a lot of officers, several thousand officers over the last several months about how can we ensure you're well but meet the demands of this job, this new landscape of policing that we're all experiencing in this social justice movement. And one of the things is they wanted notice, and we tried to do that, give them more notice to get their personal affairs prepared for working longer hours and canceled days off. And they also wanted it to be purposeful, if that makes sense. It's, let's see the data. Well, we all know Memorial Day is a really high violence day, so that was not a difficult decision. Next is Father's Day. Is every year, for some odd reason, somebody had to explain to me at some point, is increasingly more violent. And then there's 4th of July, and then there's Labor Day. So if we can, we want to, you know, kind of pace ourselves along that trend line based on data. Yes. Well, we don't have a crystal ball. You know, data says one thing, but we obviously have the experience day to day. So as our experience day to day between now and those dates, likely we could start sooner or start later. But we do want to be data driven and understand kind of where the spikes are. We have talked to officers repeatedly, not just me, all the ranks, First Deputy, Chief of Patrol, McDermott, First Deputy Carter. I mean, we've all spoken to our people about these are the dates from a historical perspective that are higher than normal. But we also day-to-day want to monitor when we might need to spend up more resources to ensure a couple of things, that officers who come to work who are not scheduled to be off have enough resources, enough officers there to protect them. You know, we want to have this theme that we are our brother's keeper and our sister's keeper on this job. That's what we do. We take care of each other. So we want enough officers here so that the officers are safe. And once the officers are safe, then we can ensure that our plans are implemented to ensure Chicago, the people of Chicago are safe. Any other questions? Yes. So we've seen since the height in January of vehicle hijackings, a 51% decrease in vehicle hijackings. And as we repeatedly said, many of these offenders are juvenile offenders. They're younger people making this very tragic decision to, you know, have a criminal record when we capture them. So we've done a couple of things. One, after the arrest and the charge, we feel like a follow-up, what's called a custom notification. We go for the juvenile, we go to their home, we talk to the parent, we bring social services with us. We offer not only the juvenile offender social services, we also offer family members social service when we go door-to-door to these people, these young people we've arrested. And we've also worked with the juvenile courts to try to have better outcomes, other services as a condition of release, so that we can have a chance at changing their behavior. Right, yeah, so one is one too many. We've had great success in capturing vehicular hijacking suspects along with those crews who can get charged with different offenses than vehicle hijacking, as you know, possession of a motor vehicle, of a stolen motor vehicle and other charges, criminal trespass of motor vehicle. So we charge the crews once we capture the person, because they usually travel in crews. They get out and someone's driving and someone's a passenger, and they actually drive the stolen car that they carjack off along with other people in the car. We try to, when we capture them, we try to charge everyone so that we can get a handle on everyone involved in carjacking. And that's proven to be successful. Likely sustainable over time. This is something that can be sustainable over time because it's a collaborative effort that includes not just Chicago police officers. It's a regional law enforcement approach that includes all of our regional, state, and other suburban police departments collaborating with us to have this effect. Any other questions? Yes. Some are not in school, and some who were in school really chose not to participate in virtual. But one of the things that we didn't mention is that CPS officials were on the ground with us over the weekend, and they have been for several weekends, helping us have influence over these young people, some who have come downtown. Many young people don't have anything to do. We've collaborated with CPS to help us have influence. The principals and teachers, we were on the west side over the weekend, myself and the mayor, with a unity parade there with Michelle Clark High School and their principals to show that connection to the community so that we can have influence over the young people. That's the first I've heard of that. We'll follow up with you after this. We haven't shown to have any hate crimes toward Asians so far in our city. That would be a new report, but we'd like to follow up with you and maybe make contact with your sources on that if they are willing to come forward and report it, because we don't have a report of that. Yes?
You said no one is celebrating this point.
Not at all. It's a long summer. So they're likely, for me at least, won't ever be a celebration. I'll never be satisfied. One crime is one too many. And I have this very, very far-reaching aspirational goal of Chicago being one of the safest cities in the country. So likely there won't be a celebration coming from me. There's a lot of hard work. There's a lot of, you know, obviously things we can do better. We're working on all of that. We're going to hold ourselves accountable to the people of Chicago. They deserve this. They deserve our full effort and focus. Thank you very much. Oh, well, last question. Last question. Yes. I think one of the things the community needs to hear from the police department is that we care about you, all parts of the community. There are certain parts of the community don't believe the police department cares, particularly these areas that are increasingly more violent than other areas of the city. So we want to convey this message that we care about you, and we want to work with you. But also, you know, we want them to be a part of the solution. And I would encourage them to get involved with any of their district community programs. And the district coordinating officer program, the MPI initiative, is coming to a neighborhood near you quickly. We're rolling out soon our strategic plan for community policing. We've been working on since I arrived last summer. We're ready to roll that out. Obviously, the quarantine, the restrictions have kind of been prohibitive, but we're ready to get involved, particularly with our young people, much more than we have. So soon to come. I don't want to do a teaser, but soon to come, a community policing strategy that's the most aggressive that you'll see in the country. We're with you. Come together and work with us with our youth programs. We want to keep your young people active and get them in programs that help. Reach out to us, and we'll respond in kind. I got a couple other questions, but if you guys go in third round, but go ahead, you right here.
Yes, so at DC 5.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, also know that police officers have been working 12-hour days, and that's been something that's also hard on them and their families. How do we meet in the middle to ensure that Chicago is safe, but also that our officers are safe and healthy too?
I think I answered that one. Do you have a new question?
Yes. I just wanted to ask you to confirm that the anti-looting task force that was created last year was in fact dissolved overnight, and if you have like any, you know, results from the past year.
Yeah, I'm going to have Bureau Detective Chief Brendan Denahan come up and answer that, if you don't mind. Thanks. Brendan.
So I'll get you the numbers. I don't have the numbers with me, but it wasn't dissolved overnight either, so I wouldn't categorize it in that manner. So basically, you know, the looting task force, it was truly, once again, it was a team effort, and there were so many different individuals involved from across the entire police department. And as we started to not get as many tips, and as we identified as many people as possible, and then all those people that were posted up on the website, less and less people were getting identified. So the detectives are still working at cases, so it's not dissolved overnight. They're still wanted individuals. Our fugitive apprehension unit is still seeking people, and we're still working the cases. But as far as new cases and moving forward, yeah, we started putting the resources, you know, back to the districts and back to where some of these officers originally worked. But the detectives who are still assigned to Area 3 and the technology officers, we're still arresting people and we're still charging them. It's just the numbers are really slowing down now. But still, it's not like it's just not completely dissolved. If someone gets arrested today, we're going to contact the state's attorney and obviously charge them. But we'll get you the specific numbers.
But it's true that we won't see police officers like these being passed over downtown in the city that we want to do with lots of that changes.
That's not changing either. I'm not sure where that reporting came from. That's not accurate. We'll continue to see increased presence in our downtown. Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.
First tonight, law enforcement and victims' advocates are angry. They believe that some judges are allowing accused criminals out on bond and giving them the opportunity to commit more crimes.
Yeah, tonight Grace White looks into the case of a man who's accused of killing someone while he was out on bond.
I was actually just literally pulling up in the parking lot of my job when my mom, she called me.
Ebony Kuti still remembers getting the call. Her older brother had been shot.
What did you think when you heard your mom say those words?
My heart literally dropped. It's like, are you serious?
It was February 9th. 29-year-old Reginald Larry was shot and killed, sitting in his car outside a corner store on Scott Street and 610 on Houston's south side.
It happened two blocks from my grandmother's house. He was actually going over there to have Sunday dinner.
The man wanted for the murder, Gerald Washington, is out on bond for another murder charge.
It was like a slap in the face.
Court records show Washington was arrested in 2018 and charged with killing one woman and shooting two others. He was released on bond even though he was already on probation for burglary in Harris County and on bond for a separate burglary in Fort Bend County.
If I was going to do a top three, Gerald Washington would probably be number one.
Andy Kahn is the director of victim services for Crime Stoppers. By his count, there are 60 people who have been killed since 2018 by defendants out on multiple felony or PR bonds.
This was an ultimate tragedy, but was so preventable if the system had been functioning from our perspective properly.
Does it come down to judges' decision? I mean, where does the buck stop?
Bottom line, it stops with the district court. In the district court, basically, it's kind of like an umpire in baseball. You're the one that determines the balls and strikes.
The judge in Washington's case is Ramona Franklin. She chose not to talk to us about the case. So we talked to Dr. Philip Lyons, the dean of the College of Criminal Justice at Sam Houston State University, for perspective. He says bond reform in Harris County has tried to level the playing field.
The fact is, some people are less able to make bond than others are, and so that leads to some racial and other inequities that we have.
But Lyon says it can be a delicate balance.
We can't afford to be too risk averse, else nobody gets released on bond. On the other hand, we can't afford to be too risk tolerant, else we end up with people perpetrating additional crimes.
The sister says if you violated bond, you shouldn't just be handed another card to get out of jail.
See, I don't want it to happen to nobody. I don't want nobody else to feel the pain that we're feeling. You know, we never got a chance to actually say goodbye.
Tonight, Gerald Washington is still on the run. There's a $5,000 reward for information leading to his arrest. If you know where he is, call Crime Stoppers. Lynn and Mia.
All right, Grace, thank you so much.
High crimes and low bonds. Tonight, the seven investigators reveal how men and women just accused of attempted murder were allowed to walk out of jail for just a few hundred bucks.
The man who made it possible is a judge who's been under the microscope before. And the seven investigator, Ross Jones, tells us his decisions have infuriated police and horrified victims.
It was like people scattered, running. I'm hit.
My grandson was upstairs. He said, get down.
17 people were shot in Detroit last weekend. Three of them died.
It appears the suspect is targeting women in the early 50s.
All while police hunted down a suspected serial rapist and killer.
The violence we've been experiencing in the city of Detroit has been heartbreaking.
And in the midst of all of it, one Detroit judge said police and victims made our city less safe. When accused criminals in Detroit are arraigned on the weekends, it happens here at 34th District Court in Romulus, where Judge Dalton Roberson is assigned. At these weekend hearings, no one from the prosecutor's office is there due to understaffing. It's where Donald Smith was arraigned this month. At this home on Sebald in Detroit, he's accused of getting into a fight with a 20-year-old man over his daughter. According to prosecutors, Smith chased him up the stairs, pointed a gun at his head, and then shot him in the neck. With two felony convictions in his past, Smith was charged with assault with intent to murder and a whole host of other charges that run a full page long. This month, Roberson set his bond at $5,000, 10%, meaning Smith only had to pay $500 before walking out of jail.
Simply ridiculous. I mean, what message are we sending to people who engage in violent, predatory crime? The message is, it's not that serious.
There's Jeffrey Sims. According to prosecutors at this gas station on Fenkel, he approached his victim, shoved him into the back of his car, and beat him in the head with a baseball bat. Charged with assault with intent to murder and unlawful imprisonment, Roberson let him walk out of jail too after posting $500. And there's Giovanna Williams. According to police and prosecutors, she came to this home on Rosemont and set it on fire, all while three women were inside. One of the victims didn't feel comfortable talking to us on camera, but said she was horrified to learn the alleged perpetrator, charged with attempted murder, walked out of jail for $500.
The public has a right to have a sense of safety.
Monica Briggins is owner of Detroit Bail Bonds, one of the many bail companies responsible for ensuring defendants like these show up to court.
So you want to make it a situation where they feel and understand that this is a serious situation. $500, I mean, anybody can pick up $500 to pay a bond.
Back in December, Judge Roberson gave this man a low bond too, Nathan Payne. He and another suspect were accused of violently attacking a woman seen on camera being beaten with a hammer. Charged with assault with intent to murder, he too walked out of jail for $500, but he never came back. He's been on the run for 161 days and counting.
We can't have certain people roaming the streets of Detroit. They're going to reoffend, and what are we supposed to do?
In response to our story, Judge Roberson sent us an email. Even though all three defendants were arraigned less than 2 weeks ago, he said he has no specific knowledge of any of those cases, but stressed that each defendant is presumed to be innocent, adding that he always considers whether the defendant poses a threat to the community and if they're likely to return to court when setting their bond.
Try to understand the impact that this is having on public safety. What if it was someone in your family?
Well, it's not just police and victims that were upset over these bonds Roberson handed out. Prosecutor Kim Worthy isn't pleased either. Yesterday, her office convinced one judge to raise the bond of Giovanna Williams, the woman accused of setting someone's house on fire, from $5,000, 10%, to $25,000, and required she wear a GPS tether. At a hearing later this month, they'll ask another judge to raise the bond of Donald Smith, who's accused of shooting a man in the neck. Yesterday, Judge Ronald Giles was asked to raise the bond of Jeffrey Sims, who's accused of beating a man in the head with a baseball bat. but he declined. All three defendants have pleaded not guilty.
Thinking we haven't heard the last of this.
I suspect you're right.
Yeah, and you wonder why, so I'll have to get down
indeed.
To that.
Well, these happen on the weekend. There's no prosecutor there. There are fewer eyes watching, and so these kinds of things happen.
All right, Ross. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow at 6, we're going to take you to a unique...
This is where I am every day, right here. We're going to start at Jackson and Pulaski, which is the West Garfield area. This is where it's a hot spot. It's a target spot.
Patricia Hilliard spends most of her time in one of Chicago's deadliest neighborhoods. She's a violence interrupter, meaning she watches for signs of a fight and tries to step in before someone gets shot.
I was born and raised around here. I've lived on just about every block from Congress on down to Madison.
You're really part of this neighborhood.
I am a part of this neighborhood. I am a product of this neighborhood. Around here, I was a gang member. I was their queen. I was considered the big hat. I was a gang chief, which is why I love being assigned to this area, because I get to give back to the community. I get to rebuild some of the things that I helped tear down. And with the people... Who's calling? I got a problem.
We're amazed. You better get it.
Oh, gosh.
What's going on, you know?
What is this, Wayne? Oh, God. No pussy camera yet. Let me defuse this. Yeah. What the fuck going on? Yeah, I know. Look, come on. Where you at? Come on, holler at me. I'm literally shaking.
What just happened then?
So that was a conflict that more than likely was finna turn to gun violence. They had guns on them. Fortunately, I knew both of the parties, so I got in the middle and was able to talk one down and put him in the car and make him put the gun away.
You saw the gun, though. You saw it.
There was plenty of them. I was able to get them separated and have him drive off, and I called him on the phone to make sure he doesn't come back. I'm not done with it, though.
Yeah.
I'm not done with it because I have to reach out to the party that it actually started with, which was yesterday, so that he doesn't come behind him.
You're tracking this whole story, where this started.
I'm on all parties. Right now, they just scared the hell out of me because there's so many. I'm just glad I was able to get him to leave, even if just for now, we stopped the shooting.
Violence interrupters have been a part of Chicago's neighborhoods for more than 20 years. But the program's now at a critical point. That's because, for the first time, the city's made a major investment in it, backing it with $23 million since 2019. But instead of a quick return, murder rates have gone up, just in time for the debate over alternatives to policing to get a lot more contentious.
We can't say on one hand that we don't want police for whatever reasons, with all the violence breaking out on the south and the west sides of the city, but we're funding organizations that have no impact.
That's created a new challenge for advocates like Vaughn Bryant, who have to prove that violence interruption really does work without getting caught up in the politics of defund the police.
What's the relationship between these programs and policing?
So if we're doing our job, we hopefully will make the police's job easier. I do think that there's always going to be a place for policing because, you know, there are certain things that we just can't handle. So we just want the police to be better and more responsible, and we want to be a part of that solution.
This model of intervention mm-hmm. has 20-plus years of being in practice
absolutely.
Here in Chicago. I mean, is it not working?
I would just say that it hasn't been consistent and sustained for a longer enough period of time. We are currently in 28 communities, but if you took the top 15 and put 10 million in the top 15, then you're gonna see some results over time, but you still have to sustain it.
Well, you're talking about $150-200 million is
mm-hmm.
kind of what you think it would take to really get into this.
Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
It's a significant amount of money.
It's a significant amount of money, yes.
Chicago currently spends almost 100 times more on policing than it does on violence interruption. To balance that out, the city will need a lot more than vague promises. Andrew Papachristos has been tracking how violence intervention programs actually impact crime rates.
Prior to COVID, we were seeing double-digit reductions in violence. And even after COVID, the neighborhoods that had outreach still did better than neighborhoods that didn't have it.
Whenever you say to someone, these programs, you know, they've been around for a while, we're not seeing large-scale impacts. The response tends to be, we need more money, we need more staffing, we need more time. When is it enough?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think to assess impact,
before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga kid. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. It's over. What I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
Who got something right? Because I ain't told you. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year, one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087, this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
What's up, everybody? This is Jay, and this video is about, is Tariq worth $2 million? Now, we all know that he's a damn fool and he deserves what he's getting, but is he worth $2 million? Before we do, let's hit that like button. I need to get 200 likes for this video, and if you haven't already, please subscribe and bang that bell. I'm trying to reach 20,000 subs by the end of the month. Let's get into it. Now, Tariq, we all know, is a damn fool. He doesn't listen to Ghost or Tasha, and he's been corrupted by Kanan and turned against his father by Kanan and Tasha, and now he thinks that he's a dope boy when all he is a dorm room dope boy. He doesn't know anything about real life situations, and so he tried to get over on Vincent and the Olive Garden dope boy crew, and he bought some baby aspirin and tried to pass it off as being some pills, ecstasy, or whatever the case. And no, that would not work. If anything, he would have been better off trying to cut it. But he's an idiot. He knows nothing about this. He thought because they look similar that Vincent wouldn't know anything. And yeah, maybe with the eye test he wouldn't know, but once they began to sell the merch, then people would complain saying that these were duds, that the strength was weak, it was nothing, and that ruined his business. Not necessarily put him out of business, but made him look bad as if he was selling duds to people trying to take their money. And Tariq already got his face smashed in the ground like a puppy that pooped on the carpet in your living room. And so that wasn't enough for him to realize that these are not the people that he should be messing with. And he came back talking about he was a man of his word.
And then he sold them a bag of bull crap, whereas he would have been better off telling them, hey, I don't have the weight. I wish I had it, whatever the case, but, you know, I'm not able to do it. I'm out. But instead, he's trying to get money and sell stuff that's not it. And even Vincent pulled out a gun in front of his face and let him know, hey, don't mess with me. And even that wasn't a good enough warning for Tariq not to do it. He's such an idiot. And so now he's in big trouble. And they want $2 million or else they were going to kill him. And my cousin Vinny, he don't give a rat's ass or a witch's titty how Ghost and Tommy come up with the money. And Tariq, he's such an idiot. He doesn't know that now what he's done has allowed Vincent to put the squeeze like toothpaste on Ghost, Tommy, and Tasha to come up with money to save his life once again. He almost had that happen when he was with Kanan and they was going to kidnap him. And then he put Proctor killed and put Proctor's daughter in a situation where she has no parents. And he think because he took her to cousin Benny's house that he did good. He had his whole apartment where he lived ruined thanks to what he did working with Tommy. He doesn't have any idea on how to think first before he causes actions, because if he did, he wouldn't have went on ahead and tried to pull that move with my cousin Vinny. And now he's sitting there looking stupid, but about to end up biting the bullet because he ended up trying to play and get over the wrong dude. These aren't the dorm room kids that you've been serving. And now the only good thing is that Tommy and Ghost are working together. Maybe they may be able to reconcile, but everybody got to keep in mind Ghost doesn't know Tommy is the one that killed Proctor and shot up his apartment. And Tariq is just sitting there looking stupid while all of this was going down with his lips poked out like he got a trout mouth or something. And he doesn't realize the magnitude of trouble he's in. Now, we know that Vincent really only wanted to keep Tariq because he knew that he could have leverage on Ghost and Tommy. And I think since every episode there's been somebody that died, I believe Vincent is going to die in episode 6. And so that'll be the end of my cousin Vinny. And if he does survive, he's definitely going down in episode 7. But Ghost, he's not going to forget this. He's not going to let this go, that this dude is extorting him. And now in order to come up with $2 million, Ghost is almost broke by between paying Jason and all the different things that he's had to do and the QCP project and things. He's almost broke. Tommy doesn't manage his money right, and he got to pay for the re-up and things, but I'm sure he probably has more money than Ghost right now. And so now Ghost is forced back into the game that he's been trying to get out since the very first episode, thanks to Tariq. And Tasha, it's just going to be a mess because she's got these other dudes that she's working with. My cousin Vinny, he's going to be looking forward to, he thinks he has the upper hand, not realizing once they pay the money and then they get Tariq back, he's screwed. Ghost and Tommy is going to get him for that. They might even get their money back. I don't know how they're going to make $2 million in 24 hours. Even if they get more weight, they're going to have to try to move all that weight in the same day. And that just because you have it doesn't mean all your connects and primaries want to buy that much right now. And so it's going to be.
Okay. Been doing some multitasking this morning. Today's podcast is titled Chicago Crime. And let me try to sew these, audios together. Okay, Chicago Crime, the majority of the audio we played this morning, except for maybe three audios. No. Actually, we can probably tie them all together. One was out of Detroit, but it mirrors what's happening in Chicago. Starters, just some of my comments. Crime and the police. The police are a reactionary body of They're not in the business of predicting who's going to commit a crime. They don't have any, to my knowledge, officially at least, or any type of computer software program or a psychic on hand to predict when crime of any type, from spitting on the sidewalk to domestic violence to murder. There's no computer program. Some people might go to a psychic, but officially they don't have that. So all they can do is react or respond to anything that comes up on their radar. Some crimes come up on their radar, but not, and I, you know what, I don't even know the percentage of crimes that actually do happen. What percentage of those crimes get permitted? How many people call into that, you know, and report it? Because if you take just a page out of the Me Too movement, where you have several women that, you know, 10, they say they were violated by whomever, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago, okay? Now, they didn't report those crimes then, if they did happen, and I'm sure many did, but that goes across the whole gamut. So a lot of crimes that do happen do not get reported for whatever reason. So the total amount of crimes committed, as I mean, if you had to get a ratio, a reported versus unreported, no idea. I'm gonna look that up. But you know, if a person doesn't tell it, it just doesn't get on the radar. Okay. So the police are reactionary things. So just my two cents. Going to the White House, unless there's some type of grant or whatever that you can, you know, Mr. President, is it possible that we can get this particular, you know, I don't know. But it's a local problem. Specifically the city of, or any city, it doesn't have to be Chicago, because Chicago's not the only town that has crime, particularly high crime. But you do have a number of people who have been leaving Chicago over the last decade or so. And I really think that's, from a do-it-yourself perspective, that is probably the best way to get off that particular radar of Chicago, because when you've got a city of that size, 3 million plus people, you're going to, in high density, when you have that many people, the more people, the more possibility of problems. You can pass all kind of legislation, and there's a whole lot of law on the books, not only for Chicago, but any city of any size of that nature. There's just, I mean, every year there's something new. The more people, the more rules and regulation, the higher the chance that, I mean, if we actually look at it, every single person who lives in Chicago or Seattle, Washington, or San Antonio, Texas, or Miami, Florida, or Boston, Massachusetts, if we pull out the law book, the rule book, everybody, in most cases, has unwittingly broken some type of law, whether we get a felony, misdemeanor, or broke some type of city ordinance. Everybody has. Or, you know what, I would put it at 99.9% of the population. It just hasn't come across, like, see, on the city level, you do have ordinances. Even HOAs, homeowner associations, they've got rules. I was at a friend of mine's house once, cutting her grass, and she put some plastic roses in her front yard, I guess for aesthetic reasons or whatever. Now, me personally, they look like real roses. Anyway, I guess one of the head honchos of the homeowners association, went walking by and knew I was just a guest, but asked me to relay a message to the owner of the house that would she remove the fake roses. Something as simple as that. And you know what? Now, the roses, fake roses were, you know, because I was out there cutting grass. So, I just to keep peace with, and I was just there for the day. And, you know, I removed them, matter of fact, before I removed them, I told the lady, who's a friend of mine, who is her townhouse, you know, what had transpired. And she didn't like it, but, you know, got the roses, fake roses, put them back in the house. But something, something that petty, and this is just my words, pretty, could escalate where you might have to call law enforcement or take it to court as a civil action or whatever. But you know, my whole thing is moved now. The reason why I play Ballin' on Baltic on this segment, Chicago Crime, is because most of the crime that happens in any city of any size, particularly when you get on a massive level like in Chicago or San Diego, typically happens in Mediterranean and Baltic Avenue locations. That's typically where you find the violent crimes. That's where a lot of those happen. So I'm going to give you an investment tip. If you're bold, buy into those areas, those Baltic and Mediterranean areas. Forget about the Park Place areas of town and all those other places. Concentrate on the Baltic Avenue and Mediterranean Avenue areas. And the indicator of that is if there's high drug activity, high arrest activity, just crime in general. Concentrate on those areas, and then when you get a chance and you've got the resources, purchase as many properties as you can. Even team up and do collaborations with other people. Get into those properties and just hold them. Because what will eventually happen in many cases, maybe not all cases, but in many cases, if you can hold on for about 15, 20, 25 years, you'll see that neighborhood becoming gentrified. So the areas where there's high crime, I mean, like, say, I saw this firsthand in, Baltimore, Maryland, the Inner Harbor, and Washington, D.C., particularly the 8th Street Northeast Corridor, the 14th Street Northwest Corridor, let's say people got, let's say they had riots in D.C. in 1968. A lot of crime and a lot of damage, particularly after the aftermath of MLK's assassination. Prostitution in a lot of pockets and on that strip. It's not like that anymore. But if you can get in those, the high crime areas, and I don't recommend it for beginners. Don't recommend it for beginners now. But I'm just planting that seed. If you are a beginner, start somewhere off where the crime rate isn't that high. And then after you get your feet wet, then look for the high crime areas, as reported by the news, online, and TV. Going to those areas, going to the Mediterranean and Baltic Avenue areas of that city, and buy on the cheap. Now, the thing is, you need to buy on the cheap. In other words, when people are fleeing that neighborhood, when they're fleeing in one direction, you go in the opposite and you go in that neighborhood. Buy and hold on to it. Like, say, bare minimum 10 years. What I would say, be prepared mentally just to stick in that neighborhood for about a solid 20, 25 years. And then set it up in your estate where, you know, because this is a generational wealth strategy too. You know, you might, it might take 30 years for that neighborhood to turn around, but it's going to eventually turn around. It's going to eventually turn around. So that's what I recommend people do. Now for the, let's see here. Matter of fact, there are TV shows that are very contemporary that they were shot in actual locations like in Baltimore, Los Angeles, New York, Atlanta. So once again, find out, you know, those areas where they shot these TV shows or movies at. And once again, those are areas that sooner or later will become very lucrative areas, and the crime would have moved. But in any event, like I said, there's a lot going on in Chicago. I believe the 50 plus people who had murder charges. And they're just charges, you know, innocent until proven guilty. But 59 people who had murder charges bailed out. And some people don't like the idea of that. And, of course, I don't know those cases, but judges have their mandate. And I can imagine the Cook County Jail is a revolving door. Let's see. Matter of fact, I'm trying to get you some information on the Cook County Jail. But my laptop is running a bit slow this morning. And let's see, let's go to another phone now. It's just telling me to wait. Okay, Cook County Jail. Okay. And thank you, Robin, for that note that I just noticed. Cook County Jail. Looking up the information.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, pressures are good, six, five, four, three, valve timing nominal, two, one, we're good to go, lift off, 5,000 miles, no excessive vibrations, 10,000 miles, temperatures are good, 15,000 miles, 17,000 miles, yes, we are in outer space! That was me, an award-winning rocket scientist sitting in mission control. I helped successfully launch Discovery, Columbia, Atlantis, and Endeavour space shuttles. I used, thank you. I used mathematics and science to calculate the probability of catastrophic explosion within a space shuttle flight. In all, I helped launch with a great team of people, 28 space shuttle missions into outer space. Now I can stand here and tell you how great it was to launch from the mission control. I can tell you how it was like to sign off and authorize multi-million dollar engine tests. But I'm not. I can tell you how great it is to be an author and a TV host now. But I'm not. Rather, I'm going to talk about you and me and what comes in our mind in the middle of challenges. Fear. What have you always wanted to do in life? Do you want to be a multi-million dollar business owner? Do you want to be the first in your family to graduate from college? Do you want to start a family? Well, for me, I always wanted to be a rocket scientist, but obstacle and roadblocks came into my path where I questioned whether or not I'd be able to do it. The truth is this, if we do not have a way to reprogram our minds to overcome fear, we will never be successful at our own specific missions in life. But there's good news. I have personally devised a three-step method to overcome fear and reprogram the brain using three key decisions, and I'm going to share them with you today. The first decision is this. You must name and reject your fear. You must name and reject your fear. Now, the easiest way for me to tell you about all these three decisions is to take you back in my life and to share with you what happened with me so you have a better idea of how to use these three decisions. And it started when I was 6 years old, and I'll never forget that day. I went on a field trip to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and there it was wonderful. I remember seeing these big engines and these jets, and we went to their mission control room, and it was amazing. I saw these big TV screens on the wall and these red plush chairs, and I also saw pictures of men launching rockets, and I said to myself, I want to be just like those men. Now, I'm not quite sure if you've noticed, I wear stilettos and skirts. I am definitely a woman. And that didn't stop me. I wanted to be just like these men. But obstacles came into my path. Now here I am, 10 years old, in the middle of a fifth grade class, and right next to me is a boy who's also 10, and he has been recruited into a gang. He and I get into arguments quite regularly because, frankly, I don't know the power of my words at this age. And he wears this ring on his finger that he files down so it acts just like a knife. And so one day in a heated argument, he takes this ring and he socks me right under my eye. Now, being a champion, an Olympian, I stand up to defend myself and everything goes blank. I cannot see one thing. I am later rushed to the hospital and I have 5 layers of stitches placed in my face, and the surgeon tells me I'm lucky. Had it been any higher, I would have lost my eye. Now, I'm pulled out of school for months, where right next door there's a crack house, and I see people getting high on the outside of my bedroom window, and our mother has a sleep in the bed in a certain direction, so if the bullets came through the house, if it came through the walls, it would hit our feet first and not our head. So in the middle of downtown Los Angeles, in poverty, face disfigured, and I want to be a rocket scientist. Next, I am placed into another school where I fail algebra, then I fail geometry, and then I go to a performing arts school and I fail chemistry, then make a D in calculus. Then a blessing occurs. And he says that if anybody wants help for their AP calculus exam, he would tutor them for free. So I jump at this opportunity, and I catch the bus 2 hours each way just to sit with this man for 1 hour. And I remember looking at the information, and I remember thinking, wait, I can get this. I can get this. I may not understand it now, but I will. I'm not going to let failure stop me. And that was the first time I learned to name and reject my fear. It would be a beautiful story if I told you that I took the AP calculus exam and passed it, but no, I failed it miserably. But what I learned is that process to invest in myself and others in education. I took those skills and graduated at the age of 16 from high school, and then later applied those skills to the university I attended, where I tutored thousands of people in mathematics through educational group programs. And I and other people learned to name and reject their fear. And I fortunately was able to be one out of top 5 graduates out of a 6,500 graduating class. You must name your fear and reject it.
Okay, Brent, heavenly. Oh, wait a minute. Technical problems today. Overall, the theme for today is Chicago crime, and I didn't mean to play that last audio because that's totally off topic. But there's been a lot of crime in Chicago and other cities of the same size. And one audio that I wanted to play for you guys, but I couldn't get it over. I'm trying to get it now still. Is of a gentleman that was just got released from the Cook County Jail, and that's a massive place. It's on 93 acres. I'm trying to get the population up. It's on 93 acres. But he gets released from the Cook County Jail, and he didn't even make it home. Somebody was waiting on him, so I guess they knew when he was going to get out, and he got shot to death. He got hit 64 times.
Man, a second. I'm trying to get that audio for it. I don't know if I'll be able to get it today, but let's see. In any event, any thoughts on that? Like, say, this guy hadn't—he just got released from jail and hadn't made it. He was about to get in because somebody was waiting on him to pick him up. So I'm trying to figure, how did they know that this person? You know what? Now I'm suspecting the person that picked him up had to be in on it. That's what I'm thinking. Because he didn't even make it to the car. I mean, he didn't make it inside of it. Oh, man. Okay, I don't think I'll be able to get... Let me see if I can... This might be it.
Chicago's violent crime rate has been on the rise for several years, but 2016 has gotten off to an especially bloody start. During the week we recently spent in the city, 10 people were killed in shooting incidents and 88 were wounded.
We have a challenge right now, specifically but not limited to the South Side and the West Side, where we have a level of shooting and a level of gun violence that's unacceptable and must come to an end.
The numbers are staggering. More than 200 people have been killed and more than 1,300 wounded in at least 1,500 shootings across the city, a marked increase from the same period in 2015.
What's up, y'all? Wings Flip. I'm here again to discuss some sick and heinous crimes that trouble our community. But before I get to that, I want to say that Indian Red Boy situation, I'm looking into it. There's some conflicting stories regarding a girlfriend, regarding another set and all that stuff, so it wasn't. Once I look into it, I'm willing to backtrack and fix my story and fix my claims. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, I did say allegedly, and at the end of the day, I just reported what I read. And it's not about all that other stuff. It's just about another man losing his life. Another man that may end up going to jail. In Chicago, Laundre Sylvester was shot 64 times. Laundre Sylvester was shot 64 times. Now, I don't know what Laundre did to deserve 64 shots. I'm not even going to comment why they did it or who did it. I don't know. My problem is we got more people that's going to go to jail because they're shooting them by courthouses outside of jails for some sort of street rep to maintain the griminess and the don't play stigmatism or stigma that surrounds Chicago. 64 times out of Cook County Jail. Now let me ask you a question. How are these people knowing what time these people get out of jail? That's my problem. How do these people know what time these people get out of jail? It's about the fourth or fifth incident that happened at Cook County Jail. The courthouse is next door. There's no cameras? How are these people knowing the time to get out of jail to kill these guys? Is that information public? I smell something fishy. I smell something fishy. It's one thing if street justice take care of street justice. No crime is right in my eyes, and I'm preaching to the youth. But when we have people that seem like they're on the inside infiltrating our communities and allowing us to kill each other, or having people feel like it's giving them the bravado, the strength, the will to shoot someone 64 times outside of a jail, that just put them out there in the street. Y'all don't put them on a bus. Y'all don't give them the... Y'all just put them out there in the street. 64 times. How does the person know what time they get out? It says it on the time, okay. That man, he violated and he made his $50,000 bail. This man put up $5,000. He was killed. Two people were shot along with him. A 60-year-old woman was shot. And another woman was shot in the mouth. It grazed her. 64 times he got shot. Sit outside of a courthouse, outside of a jail. And you mean to tell me that no one see the issue here? That we're not being set up to destroy each other? You mean to tell me that no one sees the bigger picture? Because I'm confused. Now, I can't comment. I don't know the story. I just know there's another life that's lost. Rest in peace to that man. My condolences to his family. Man hopped out of the vehicle. Two men hopped out of opposite vehicles and riddled him with bullets. Passed away in the hospital. 64? My thing is that you incarcerate us because you don't want us to be a menace to society. You incarcerate us because of our crimes we do, and a lot of times, a lot of men don't deserve the incarceration, but there's some that do. Now, after incarceration, to keep us out of trouble, you push us right back on the street to get killed. You mean to tell me there's no funniness, there's no, I need to know. Please tell me in the comments if I'm wrong. Please tell me in the comments that, Flip, there is a way to find out what time you get out. Nobody on the inside of Cook County Jail got to tell you. But this is not the first incident. It's three or four. Let me tell you, 2017, a man was killed. Kamari Belmont. He beat a murder case. He was killed. 2 weeks later, another man was shot 6 times in the groin. Coming outside Cook County Jail, going down, walking to the courthouse. 2017 to August 18, Kenneth Williams was shot and killed coming out of Cook or in that area. Since when? Like, that's like us going to Queens and doing stuff by the, like, that's like doing stuff by the, like, Chicago is a whole different lead, and I can't judge or because you know what it is? I can't just blame the people out there, even though we got to take accountability. I got to blame the circumstances. I got to blame the conditions of society. I got to blame the lack of fathers. I got to blame the lack of mentors. I got to blame a lot of these things. I got to blame the wanting to be tough and wanting to keep a reputation to live a long time. You know, people, and I say this each and every time, people have it messed up. The streets is a myth. The streets don't love no one. The streets don't love me nor you. You may have a temporary status and temporary respect, but as time goes, somebody else fills that spot. As time goes, someone else fills the spot. It's like a gumball machine. The little knob is time. You put it, you come out. He's gone. It's the same thing. And even if I didn't explain that gumball machine right, you guys get it. It sounded better in my head. But at the same time, this is sick. This is sad. We got to stand up. We got to come together, man. It's no better. New York Governor Cuomo has stated a state of emergency for the violence in New York City. They are killing people by courthouses. I'm not here to judge anybody. Because it's a lot of things that happen in life that I couldn't control that I've watched happen on the internet that I couldn't control. So I can't judge, and I saw it like, what's going on? But a lot of times as I got older, it breaks my heart to see my brothers getting killed. It breaks my heart to see my brothers being set up. It breaks my heart to see my brothers not being protected. It breaks my heart to see guns being dropped in the street to the youth. It breaks my heart to see that we all of a sudden have access to all these wonderful guns and rocket launchers. We got access to rocket launchers. It breaks my heart. So it is what it is, right? I'm mad at Cook County Jail. We need to boycott that. They need to shut it down. Because you're keeping us in there for what? To put us out there to die? Cook County Jail need to be shut down. or it's not the jail fault. Well, they system need to change, because apparently they're knowing, people are knowing when enemies are getting out of jail and able to kill them in front of the jail, next to the jail, down the block from the jail. In Manhattan, you can't even go next to a federal building or a jail or do something. That's not even, like, huh? It's designed that way. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but sometimes you got to call it. If it's red, it's red. If it's blue, it's blue. If it's old, it's old. If it's new, it's new. And this right here is something that we all got to deal with and pay attention to. Because this right here is a part of the problem that's keeping our community where it's at.
Crime in Chicago. Well, Warren Houston, I believe that's you. What are your thoughts?
Well, just listen to the brother. First of all, good morning, L.A. And,
good morning, Warren.
It's my house. You know, he's speaking purely from emotions. There's no facts based off of his speech. I don't know about crime in Chicago, but should I just say crime in America? And that's one of the reasons why I pushed the button when you first started talking about it. There has to be a problem, whether it's in the police station, but the police station would not be the root of the problem. When a man is gunned down and shot 64 times, who does that? That's a serious problem. This other rapper in California, in Los Angeles, Indian Red Boy, 21 years old, murdered on Instagram, shot about 10 to 12 times.
Well, they did a live feed of that?
Yeah, if you haven't seen the video, I'll send it to you. It's a 29-second clip. This rapper, okay, Indian Red Boy, was talking to, and what was so cool about it, the question that was asked right before he was murdered was what, in the sense of what happens if you get caught without a weapon. And while he was talking, somebody just literally walked up to his car and just let him have it. You hear about 10 to 12 bullets rang out. And when he looks up at the camera, he has blood coming out of his nose, his face, and he's hollering for help. He's gasping for air. So maybe, I guess, one of the bullets must have hit his lung. The guy asks him where he is. He tells him he's in Hawthorne or somewhere. And I guess the fight to try to breathe, he drops the phone and dies. You know, this is the kind of madness we look at among African Americans, and we have the audacity to get up and attack folks in the sense that there's something wrong with them as the reason why we can't get ahead. Something is wrong with us in general. And until we stop again and get back to accountability and responsibility, this type of stuff will continue and it won't get any better.
Yeah, it's boy, that is just terrific. You said, what's his name again?
Indian Red Boy.
Okay.
This just happened, I think, what was it, July 8th in Los Angeles, in the city of Los Angeles. And, I mean, you can go back to Nipsey Hussle. Nipsey Hussle, who, from my understanding, was a rolling 60s, and even though there are different gang affiliations, because of the type of person he was, he gained love and respect from all gangs in the Los Angeles area, but yet it was one right there in his own crew or clique that killed him in front of his own store after shooting him dead, stomping him in the face. What is that? Is that jealousy or what? Because, you know, Nipsey Hussle's idea was, you know, I'm not going to leave the hood. I'm going to help these brothers in the hood and show them we don't have to kill one another, we don't have to fight one another, but we can build positive businesses.
Right.
He's murdered right there. You know, Lil Boosie, the rapper from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I thought about Nipsey Hussle when this happened, because this interview happened before Nipsey Hussle was killed. And they asked Lil Boosie about moving back to Baton Rouge. Lil Boosie said these words. He said, you know what? He said, I love Baton Rouge. That's my hometown. That's where I'm from. He said, but I will never go back there to live. And the reason why I won't go back there to live, if the police don't get me, one of these jealous Negroes will kill me. So he's never ever going back to his hometown to live as much as he loved it. And this is the sad thing. And it's almost like it's just for the blacks, the African Americans who do get it and do rise out of poverty and out of pestilence or whatever you want to call it and rise up out of the mud and become successful. It's almost a barrier to try to cross back over and get them because now you're labeled as an Uncle Tom, you're this and you're that. And so it's like you can't pull those people across.
That type of mindset goes back thousands of years.
You know, we don't
want to
talk
about it. Yeah, I remember when Nipsey, because I heard when they shot Nipsey, the guy who did it, shot him, then walked away a little bit, then came back and finished him off.
And, yeah, kicked him, stomped him in the face on top of it. I mean, man, when I look at it, I'm like, okay, you just shot him. You got to stomp him too? You know, who shoots somebody 64 times? That's madness.
Yeah, that's somebody that weak.
Which I don't believe it was one person, but I mean, you know, no one.
I think it was at least two. A car rolled up, and people. I don't know if it was two or more, but it was at least two that got out of the car and killed him. And I'm even thinking, was the person who picked him up, were they in on it? Because jails don't announce when you're going to get out. You might get a release date, but not a specific time, unless the Cook County Jail has a routine thing. Well, at 3:30 Monday through, unless it's something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to have to research that. But they were sitting there waiting on.
And so everything evolves around evaluation. As to why things are the way. I mean, especially if you want to, and it's so sad because people want to blame the white man about slavery. But if you go back to the roots of slavery, it's like I tell people all the time, you want to be even mad about slavery, why don't you look at your people? Because slavery would not have existed if it was not for the kings of the African tribes. You know, we get this concept that they just come over there. No, they didn't just come over there and take Africa. One black person wouldn't have been taken off the continent if the kings of Africa wouldn't have allowed it.
Right. I know one figure in African history, they say he's probably arguably the wealthiest man who's ever lived. I guess between him and Genghis Khan, somebody like that. Mansa Musa. He had a number of slaves. But a lot of people don't talk about that. Now, you know what? One stat I need to find out, how the black population is being reduced in a place like Chicago. Just by, blacks killing blacks. Because when you eliminate somebody like that, you're reducing the human capital.
Right.
And the potential intellectual capital of that particular community.
And that's the sad part, because none of us want to go the way of education. You know, we want to go the way of emotions and how we feel, and we want to pop off and flip off and feel like we done something, said something, and we ain't made no progress because we want to talk about so-called bourgeoisie niggas and all that other kind of foolishness. But when you apply education demands transformation of you. Education demands that you think in a different way. Education demands that you move in a different way. And education is not being held back from anyone. This whole United States, if you don't, and it's not that a formal education is for everybody, but I'm just saying, if you don't even have the money to go to school, there are grants and scholarships. There's really no excuse.
There's loads of them.
Yeah, it's no excuse. Even when I was college, people
and you know what? The public library is a good resource as well.
The resources are all around everyone, L.A. It's up to you to take advantage of. The Harris County Law Library here in Houston, it has so many resources, but when you walk in there, it's practically empty. It's empty. And these are free resources by the county. Even when I got ready to go to school, people, well, you gonna pay all that money in school? Look, I'll cross that bridge when I get there because the education of college is more than just about the bill. It's about the knowledge that you'll receive. Not only is it about the knowledge you'll receive, it's also about the connections that you'll get.
The best resource of any type, even a community college, is the contacts.
Yes.
Yep, the relationships that you can build, which is priceless.
You know, Ellie, I had a man call me just yesterday, and we talked about this on your show, maybe about a few years back, and you brought me on to talk about filling the precinct chair. I had a brother call me, well, he's a white guy, call me yesterday about helping fill the precinct chairs because they are literally empty. The Republican precinct chairs are literally empty in most black neighborhoods in this whole city. You know, and that's a source of connection. Once you get in there and you connect,
right,
you find out who's who and what's what, and you get closer to people that you couldn't even imagine that you could get close to.
That's true. You're absolutely right about that. Hold on, Warren. We got another caller here real quick as we're in overtime. 314, your mic is open.
L.A. and King Warren, Houston. Commissar.
Yes, good one.
L.A., you know, these people curse, man. They must be cursed.
And my mother
and
used
you
to
talk about,
say that occasionally.
Yeah, you talking about Chicago. Chicago's got black everything in there. Leadership, police, everything. So if you don't attend that much to what people have said in the past as things being wrong, and it's still going on worse than ever, it's got to be something else. If Naima can say that blacks are suffering from slave syndrome, or some people can say it's in the DNA, well, let's go to the spiritual. Some of these folks are cursed. And I don't know what to say. Heck, in 42 days, you don't have 795 people shot.
I'm going to have to bring Naima on here, see if she can explain what's going on.
In 42 days.
She's from Chicago and lives in Chicago.
Look, 42 days, 795 people shot, black shot by other blacks, and 112 murders. In 42 days.
That's
do the math
that's
on
insane.
That. Yeah, that is insane. And then now you got people like this last guy where this guy got shot 64 times talking about closing the jails. But that wasn't something new saying. They talking about closing the jails, getting rid of the police, blacks fleeing, all these fancy slogans and jingles. That stuff don't mean anything.
It's a bunch of talk.
Somebody made mention about 500. See, they don't want no, I thought they didn't want no bail. You got people out there say they don't want bail because I guess blacks can't pay for it. Hell, but
that argument was out there. It probably still is out there in some circles. But like you said, Chicago has got a black mayor, black female mayor, plenty of black judges. The chief of police is black. So
prosecutor's black.
The prosecutor's black.
The lieutenant governor is black.
Okay, so there's a
black congressman
there somewhere.
Bobby Rush and the other guy, Danny Davis,
yeah,
they black. They're congresspeople.
And also remember Farrakhan's in Chicago, Jesse Jackson's in Chicago. And some of the wealthiest people in the country, and they just happen to be black. I think George Johnson with Johnson Products, I think he's still alive.
You got blacks having to move and lose money on their property value. Who's going to pay reparations to them? Should blacks pay reparations because they're the one who is the excusable force? You got idiots talking about, well, it's because they didn't have a family. Well, it's because they done bad in school. Well, hell, just like Warren say, all the resources that's available and whites left it to you. You say, we don't want white teachers. We want black. You got black teachers. And look at it. And I get sick and tired of being included in this group and conversation. Like, we must take care of our people. That ain't none of my people. I sent you an email today. And it showed the 2019 eight co-winners of the Spelling Bee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just had a young black girl from Louisiana, and she was from Harvey, Louisiana, which is majority white. And she was homeschooled. But first thing people want to do is say, yeah, she's African-American. Yeah. But look at those 2019 co-winners. They all darker complexion than she is. But guess what? They ain't black. They ain't African-American. They Indians. So now what? People forever want to include you into their mix. And they don't want to be in that mix. Case in point, just look at that. And then, too, the children that's doing excellent and working hard and so on, they get no mention. And you're taking resources from them, like in Chicago, to fight this crime. Look at the money that's been spent on this ridiculous stuff that's going on. Police would never be able to trace down who done those 4,845 shootings last year with 745 murders. Ain't no police department. Hey, you can take Israel, the UK, and the US intelligence, and they couldn't figure out who done that.
Yeah, it's just too much. It's overload.
Hell yeah. And I don't blame the police. I wouldn't be running after this mess, because when you do the right thing, then people criticize you about excessive force. How do you deal with idiots? These people are worse than idiots. And all these kids being shot, killed. Like I told you the other day, kids got to run the school zigzag to keep from possibly getting hit by a bullet. Why come nobody's making a movie on that? The news media with their ratchet and fake and conniving self, they don't talk about this. Why come that's not on CNN? So I don't know what to tell you. I really don't, Warren. I lived a while. I ain't never seen nothing like this. Ain't nothing like this in no other country. You talking about people, then people going to say, well, when whites live around whites, they kill each other. Blacks live around blacks, they kill each other. When ain't no ethnic group, no place on the planet that's doing the kind of stuff that's going on in Chicago. You can take some countries that's got 99% black, 30 million population. Ain't no mess like going on like that.
Yes, you think it's going to end up like I don't know.
No, what's going to happen? They're just going to let people keep killing each other. If there is anything about genocide, just let them kill each other. I'm looking at something here now in Detroit. It's some of the most ridiculous mess you ever want to see. And they talking about a Wakanda. If there is a Wakanda, where can we contribute to a Wakanda? Warren, you know?
And it's Texas, you know, Texas is the biggest state in the union. It's
everybody moved out of Texas and say, okay, we're gonna give all African Americans, all black folks, the whole state of Texas. What do you think would happen to this state?
Shit. I tell you what, we would have to come down there and rescue you.
You know, at Texas, I went to undergraduate school up in the Panhandle. And it all depends, that's my opinion, it depends on what part of Texas you move to. Because I was up in the Panhandle up in Canyon, Texas. That's about 17 miles south of Amarillo. And it took me, I went through a culture shock. And some of the guys that came down, you know, up to that school on, like, athletic scholarships, some of them left before the end of the semester or didn't come back the next year. So it all depends on what, in that part of Texas, I would call, I mean, really Texas. I mean, it's flat. I mean, they're different. Texas got different type of terrains. But this part of Texas is flat. You can see forever. Cowboy boots are normal. Stetson hats are normal. People duffing skull or whatever they call it. Tobacco normal. But you go to El Paso, totally different. You go to Dallas, totally different. I've only been to Houston twice. Totally different.
El Paso, Texas has been Democrat forever.
I don't think every black is.
In Houston,
they would have to go to certain
Houston
cities.
Houston is different than Dallas.
Right.
Yeah. And every part of Houston, every part of Texas got a different feel, but in the sense that you would give all blacks this state. It's not to say we don't have any. We do have some black educated people, but the fool's going to outnumber them. So
yeah, you're right.
Wouldn't get anywhere.
Ain't nobody going. I wouldn't sacrifice my kids to that. My daughter never went to a public school. My grandson started off in private schools, and later on, of course, he was a male. He wanted to get involved in some sports. Then he went to a public school, but he went to a private high school. I think he stayed in public school 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And look, we ain't talking about the kids. It's the parents and the family of each child that you can point the finger at. Then you got these politicians, but it's the parents and the families voting for these politicians. And then you got these schools. It's the parents and the families voting for these school boards. They just make money off the kids. Kids not learning. Then when you have a good child like this girl that win the spelling bee, these black voices, black nationalists, black activists and things want to claim her. No, that girl come from a whole different culture. One thing, she was homeschooled. It's just, you know, it's just ridiculous. I don't know what to
say. Like you say, Pianchi, not all blacks are alike. So some, as Warren said, the ones who get educated and believe in continuing education, they'll be all right. And then others who don't, they'll wash out.
With the opportunities that exist in the United States, I really don't understand it.
You know,
look at all them Indians on. Go ahead and work.
You can't really see until you become educated. And I've said this, and I've said it 1,000 times more about my mentor, who's originally from Montgomery, Alabama, and he's practiced law in this city for over 30 years. And when I first started my law course, he told me, he said, man, by the time you finish this course, please be careful with your friends and family, how you treat them, how you talk to them. And I had no clue what he meant. But by the time I finished, I understood, because the foolishness was wiped away. The emotional ignorance that I operated in the same way that everybody else operated, because I didn't know no better. I was raised in it too. But going to law school removes emotions. It teaches you to be a stoic. It teaches you to think. It teaches you to be logical and to be intellectual. And when you do that, then you start to see the foolishness in a lot of stuff our people do. This is why the People's Law Study Group was birthed. I said, well, wait a minute. I understand this thing totally different. Let me go back into my communities and show these brothers and sisters what the deal is, and we can kind of level the playing field once they understand the game. But at the end of the day, I became Uncle Tom in the cool. Now, this is the same brother from Fifth Ward that used to sell dope and do all this other stuff. But because I enlightened myself and educated myself and came out of that and wanted to come back and share that,
that I became Uncle Tom, I became a coon, all this foolishness. So at this point of stage where I am, especially at 50 years old, I gladly accept that title because I'm not going back to that foolishness at all.
There's a lot of
well,
it out
Warren,
there.
I hope you get an opportunity to work with those programs you've talked about, and I think I told you about a couple of them, and of course with this thing with Carrie, because there's a need for it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to get people to take advantage of. You know, that's another thing. Many of the conditions that exist amongst this all black within the community, solutions are don't tap into them.
Mm-hmm.
And they want everything for free to laugh at. Some of them lectures.
Either they want it free or they want it free from us.
They're
getting in trouble.
Years ago, them lectures charging people, they still charging $20.
So, yeah, there's a, yeah. I got a thing on my page, on my Facebook page that says the reason why the mouse get caught in the trap because he don't understand why, he don't realize why the cheese is free.
Yeah, I've seen it. But anyway,
yeah,
I was telling you yesterday that I ran across a video on with some people in Ghana was doing with the small tiny homes. They're selling one for $18,000. I wanted you to call me, and I was going to give you some more details on it.
Yeah,
show
I got
you
caught
where you
up,
look
but
at
I'm going to give you a call for sure this afternoon. Because I was even scrambling during this podcast. anyway, it's 101 on this end, which is way over time, and I don't want Blog Talk to drop us instantly, which they've been known to do. So on that note, Pianca, I'll call you about it in a couple hours. On that note, everyone have a good day.